There we go. All right, this is session 165, which is titled How We Wrote Mormon History. My name is Heather Harris Bergevin, and I am your moderator today. And we have an awesome panel and some great history to talk about, so let's get into it. Every book has a great backstory. The recently published book, Writing Mormon History, allows the reader to enter into the historian's world. Each chapter is written by a well-known historian, describing the journey of writing books that have shaped our understanding of the Mormon past, offering an unprecedented glimpse into why they wrote these important works. Come join the editor and some of the authors of Writing Mormon History as they discuss the book and answer your questions. And I am going to see if I can add the podcast link and the book link itself into the Whova app as we go along to make sure that we have that information. All right, I want to give you a second to get to know the people that you're going to be listening to today. Joseph W. Geisner is an independent Mormon researcher who collects rare books, writes book reviews, and speaks at history conferences. He has published in the Journal of Mormon History, Sunstone, John Whitmer Historical Journal, Ariantum, and various LDS-oriented websites. Along with Lavinia Fielding Anderson, they created the chronology, I am so sorry, for Confessions of a Mormon Historian, the Diaries of Leonard J. Arrington, 1971 to 1999, which was edited by Gary J. Bergera. He is currently on the board of directors for the John Whitmer Historical Association. An anthology that Joe edited was recently released from Signature Books, Writing Mormon History, Historians and Their Books. And together with his wife of more than 30 years, he lives in Northern California, where they provide residential services for people with developmental disabilities. The Geisners have three children. Polly Aird is an independent historian in Seattle. She's the author of Mormon Convert, Mormon Defector, A Scottish Immigrant in the American West, 1848 to 1861, which is University of Oklahoma Press, 2009. This received the Best Biography Award from the Mormon History Association in 2010. She is also co-editor with historians Will Bagley and Jeff Nichols of Playing with Shadows, Voices of Dissent in the Mormon West, University of Oklahoma Press, 2011, which received the Best Documentary Book Award from the Utah State Historical Society in 2012. She has written articles for a number of historical journals. And Vicki Cleverly Speak is a former newspaper and radio reporter, feature writer, and columnist in Illinois and Michigan, recipient of four first place awards from the Illinois Press Association, and recipient of the Red Ribbon Media Award from the state of Illinois. In 2001, she received the Award of Excellence from the Illinois Historical Society for her research and writing on the Civil War. She is past director of the LDS Family History Center in Morris, Illinois. In 2006, she published God Has Made Us a Kingdom, James Strang and the Midwest Mormons at Signature Books. And in 2013, The Amazing Jimmy Mays, Sideman to the Stars from the University Press of Mississippi. Currently, she is a freelance writer and editor living in Port Charlotte, Florida, where she enjoys gardening and collecting books, which she will probably never get around to reading. That sounds a lot like me. Welcome, y'all, and thank you so much. I am going to leave to your session. I will be here, but I will allow you to be unmuted and do your session, of course. And then we are going to leave a little bit of time at the end for question and answers. Those that want to ask questions in the Whova app, I will be monitoring those and pinning them so that we will have them ready during that time. Thank you very much, and I'll give you your time now.
We actually, yes, we, Vicki, we actually unmute ourselves. Heather doesn't unmute us. So I just sort of figured that out. Like to welcome everyone today, and I really appreciate all of you attending. I'm also feel quite honored that Vicki and Polly are willing to sit down with me. I was extremely honored that they even were willing to do a chapter in the book. It's not something that women have wanted to do, actually. It was very difficult to find women to write chapters for the book. And Polly and Vicky both not only did it against the norm, but they wrote fantastic chapters. Many people have told me their chapters are actually their favorite. There are 15 chapters. This is the book, if you can see it okay. And I'm going to list the names quickly. Polly Aird, who's with us, Will Bagley, Todd Compton, Brian Hales, Mel Johnson, William McKinnon, Linda King Newell, Greg Prince, D. Michael Quinn, Craig Smith, George D. Smith, Vicky Speaks, Susan Staker, Daniel Stone, John Turner. We had four women, Vicky and Polly, obviously, Linda and Susan. We'll get in more about the themes that went through, but their chapters stand out, the four chapters. We also had three non-Mormon scholars, Polly being one of those, William McKinnon, who I believe is Episcopalian, Polly probably. Is that correct, Polly?
Presbyterian.
Oh, Presbyterian. So just like John Turner, because John is also Presbyterian. The other thing that we had was Daniel Stone did not grow up in the Utah church. He grew up in what's called the Church of Jesus Christ, which is a church that's headquartered in Pennsylvania. They're an offshoot of the original church, just like Brigham Young was an offshoot of the original church. And it was Sidney Rigdon who went to Pennsylvania. And well, you can read Daniel's book to learn all about that. I'm just going over my notes. So we had some themes that historians, as they wrote their books, and then as they wrote their chapters, and no one saw other chapters as they were being done. And I received chapters probably over about 8-9 months, maybe close to a year. And it's interesting because we had these themes come through. George Smith has about the life of Joseph Smith. Susan Staker and George also talked about the Book of Mormon. The life of Emma Smith covered in Linda Newell's chapter. Brian Hales dealt with early polygamy. Todd Compton and George Smith also did, but were even further about the wives that Joseph Smith had. Vicky, she talked about James Strang and the Strangites. One of my favorite, and I wrote a review early on, it was one of my first reviews I ever did, and Signature posted it on their website. But I loved Vicky's book because she gets into the women that were involved with James Strang. John Turner covers Brigham Young's life. Susan Staker talked about, she's writing a book, but also her previous work, both on the primary children and the primary history, and Wilford Woodruff's diaries. That is a monumental experience. Susan went through and read every single page of Wilford Woodruff's diaries. Will Bagley covered Mount Meadows Massacre in Blood of the Prophets. He's also covered many other things and actually will be presenting Saturday on his latest book. William McKinnon dealt with the Utah War. And that was actually a long period of time that Bill did that. And he's actually caused us to completely understand the Utah War in a completely different way. Greg Prince both covered David O. McKay and Leonard Arrington. Mike Quinn gave us his diary entries, and we were allowed to publish those, which is quite the experience. Do either of you have any comments you wanted to bring out right now, or Vicki, do you? You can just go on with your.
Vicki, go.
Well, I, first of all, I'd like to thank everybody for coming. I think this is fun. Isn't it fun?
Yes.
And my brother asked me to give him a shout out because he was going to watch for me. So, Matt, I'm glad you're here.
Thank you, Matt.
From Seattle. I think this is an absolutely amazing book. There were four of us that had the topics absolutely dropped in our laps. We just stumbled into these books, and when we had no idea that we were going to write them. Now, Polly grew up in a family hearing a rousing tale written by her great-grandmother about her family, her grandparents and grandparents' family that were from Scotland, and they became converted to Mormonism in the 1840s and 50s. They went over the seas to Nauvoo and across the plains and joined the saints in Nauvoo, and it was a very, very interesting story, and also about how the family they apostatized, and so they requested the U.S. Army troops to escort them out of Utah. So her chapter is the story of how she was seeking out the story of her family and wanted to find out the truth of the legends, and it's really interesting what she found. Now, my favorite part of her story is Polly's story is when she went to an MHA conference for the very first time, and she found the whole event very, very overwhelming. She went back to the place where she was staying, and she said, "I need a drink of wine." That was one of my favorites. Because when I met Polly, it was also at an MHA conference. And she poured herself a cup of coffee right in front of me and very casually drank it in front of me. And I thought, oh, how bold is that? I didn't know she was a Catholic. So that's fine. That was my favorite story of how I met Polly too. Now, Todd, his chapter is called Plural Accidents, that occurred to him in writing the sacred in Sacred Loneliness. So the first odd accident was that Todd had no interest at all in writing about any subject in Mormon history, let alone plural marriage. So a friend suggested that he apply for a summer fellowship at Huntington Library to transcribe the Overland Diaries of Eliza R. Snow. This was the first odd accident because he had no interest in Mormon history. The second one was that he listened to his friend and applied for the fellowship. The third was that he got accepted with no experience whatsoever in Mormon history. And the fourth was that he began transcribing the diaries and realized that he needed a key to the writings of Eliza R. Snow and a list of the people that she associated with. That became his book in Sacred Loneliness as he began to compile the list of plural wives. And his little biographies became big biographies. Now, Greg Prince had the best title for his chapter. His chapter in our book was How I Did It, Writing David O. McKay and the Rise of Modern Mormonism. But it reminds me of something that a former football player would write about murdering his ex-wife, How I Did It. So anyway, Greg wrote the two books. One was titled Power on High, Development of Mormon Priesthood, and the other one was about David O. McKay. And he claims that the David O. McKay book chose him because Greg and his wife had the mission president, Bob Wright, and his wife over for dinner one night in Washington, D.C. They were talking about Greg's books, and Bob happened to mention, "Do you know who Claire Middlemiss is or was?" And Greg said, "Well, yeah, I know that she was President David O. McKay's private secretary." And Bob Wright said, "Well, she was also my aunt." Wow, what a connection right there. I mean, talk about it falling in his lap. And not only was Claire Bob's aunt, but she had left him her personal collections of documents about President David O. McKay. She had intended to write a book, but turned it over to him when she was unable to do it. So she asked Bob to write the book. She gave all of her stuff to him, and Greg was pleased to see that her personal collection contained two pallets of documents covered by a blanket in Bob's basement in Utah. It consisted of 40,000 pages of diaries and over 200 scrapbooks. So Bob and Greg supplemented with over 200 personal interviews of people that they tape recorded. And talk about coincidences, there was even a painting of David O. McKay that had already been done by Arnold Freiberg, and it had been sitting in a shed for 40 years. And that's the cover, the book that's on the portrait that's on the cover of the book. So, and then me, I had no intention at all on writing a book. I was just going to make a basket. I was living in northern Illinois. I went to Burlington, Wisconsin. And right on the corner where the basket making supplies were was a sign that said Mormon Road. I was so surprised, and I thought, no, that can't be. Because I know, as a fifth and sixth generation Mormon, that there were no Mormons in Wisconsin. So I drove down the road, found plaques and monuments and houses of the people that lived there in the 1840s and 50s. I decided to research them to find out who they were and what they were all about. And I had an ulterior motive with that I will tell you about later. Okay, that's it. Now, Polly.
Yes, thank you. And welcome everybody here. This is a great chance to help you understand what the complexity and the richness of this book. A number of us found real obstacles to writing. For myself, I was a single parent, and I had to make my own income. I had no child support. And so that was working full time and writing a book don't go together. And Todd Compton was in a similar situation. He had to earn a living. And Brian Hales is a doctor and was practicing medicine. And so just finding the time to write or research and write, it was complicated. And I must say, Joe has a full-time job of running two houses, is it? And is it disabled?
Developmentally disabled, Polly, that's okay. Correct. Thank you.
So, I mean, that has to be an enormous challenge. Then there were Linda Newell and her co-author, Val Avery, were both mothers of four children each. I don't know how they did it. I can't imagine. I have two children and that was plenty. And then Linda also had to work. Her co-author, Val Avery, was in Flagstaff, Arizona. So coordinating between the research and the writing of the chapters and passing things back and forth, really before the internet was available. I don't think even email was there.
Well, and something just to add to that, Polly, is Ron Prittis the other day said to me, it's Signature Books, he said, to think that, you know, when he read Linda's chapter, he said, to think that Linda would have to get on Greyhound and go all the way down to Flagstaff, yeah, or Val would have to do the opposite, yeah, in order for them to even get together.
Yeah, yeah, no, that's incredible. Yeah. And then Will Begley found that he was not allowed to use many, many church documents in the Church Historical Society, in the library, church library now called. And then Greg Prince had a co-author who developed Alzheimer's, and he had to then carry on by himself. So there were just a lot of big challenges to just research and writing. Oh, also, I live in Seattle, so getting to Utah was a constant challenge too. Although I didn't take Greyhound, I drove usually. Okay, Joe.
There's a period of time known as the Reformation, which is in the 1850s. And four of the books really are about that time period, or at least you can get the feel for that time period. All four books brought us information that had not ever been known. Polly, first published in Journal of Mormon History, and then in her two works about murder that was going on in Utah, the Parrish Potter murders for starters, and the threats to her own ancestors upon leaving Utah. These were stories that had really been forgotten. You could find them in some books, but for the most part, those were books that had long been forgotten. They had basically been written out of Mormon history. John Turner deals with Brigham Young and his life. Well, obviously, Brigham Young spanned the 1850s in Utah, was the most powerful man probably in the West during that time. And because he was territorial governor of Utah, as well as the church president. And so he had such control. And John was given access, speaking of Will, as Polly brought up about Will, John was given incredible access, actually records to this day that are not available to the average person to be able to see. Those are in the Brigham Young collection. They mainly deal with divorce, excommunication, any of those kinds of controversial subjects. They're off limits, but John got to see those. And so they're actually, in one particular case, John got to see that we had known about it from a dissertation or a thesis about a man named John Lewis being castrated in Springville, Spanish Fork area. But John was given access to the mother's letters, and those kinds of letters still are not available to John Lewis. Will, obviously dealing with maybe the most controversial of all, was on Mountain Meadows with Blood of the Prophets. Will was allowed to look at things that Juanita Brooks didn't even know existed. Will surrounded himself with people like Polly and Bill McKinnon and different people like that to give him different ideas and to help him look at things differently. And just a sidelight with Will's book. Well, first of all, if you read anything by Hal, like God Hath Wrought, or What Hath God Wrought? Is that it, Polly?
It's Hal, Hal Schindler.
No. I'm Hal. Hal's book on, okay, what on the railroad.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
he quotes Will Bagley mm-hmm. when he's dealing with the Utah, and particularly the Southern Utah stuff. And with that, Will's book stands out. And it was voted just maybe 10 years ago at Tops in the top six of all nonfiction works by the Western Writers Association. So Will's book is huge and massive. Bill, reading his volumes, he's done two, and reading his volumes about the Utah War changes our understanding. Let me give you a little teaser here, but Bill found where Brigham Young had set up a home for the territorial governor, Albert Cummings, to replace Brigham Young, found him a home in which he was there. His wife was still out in Wyoming and had very young women taking and doing the household chores. And Cummings was spied on by the owner of the home and given the information. All of Cummings' letters were all open and read. Bill found all that information. Lastly, but very important, is Polly's work. Polly dealing with her ancestors and also the important work she did in Playing with Shadows. Lindsay Hanson Park says Playing with Shadows is her favorite book, that it has touched her more than any other book in helping her understand. Playing with Shadows is essential. Okay, Polly?
Yes. The Playing with Shadows is about dissenters from Mormonism, people who had trouble with the church. They didn't all leave the church, but they certainly had problems. I wrote about George A. Hicks, who was a very forthright person, and his so it's his journals that I've annotated, and he managed to get excommunicated twice, but was still brought back in the church before he died by Reed Smoot. So in talking about how I got into Mormon history, I grew up in the San Francisco Bay Area, and I knew nothing about Mormonism. My mother came from a Quaker Episcopalian background. My father, his grandparents had left the Mormon church, and so he really grew up as nothing. But my grandmother had written this story of her, based on what her mother had told her. But her mother was actually born in California. My grandmother was born in California after her mother and family had left Utah. So my grandmother wrote this when she was in her 80s, and her mother had been dead for 40 years. So, like some oral histories, they're not always very accurate. And my challenge became, how do I figure this out? It was a dramatic story. It was well written. And a lot of it wasn't true. But the broad outline was true. As I spent a lot of time researching, decades, I found the broad outline was true. The family had converted to Mormonism in Scotland in the 1840s. They had emigrated to Utah in the early 1850s. They became disillusioned and feared for their lives. And they asked the U.S. Army for an escort out of Utah because they were fearful. And they were given one in 1859. And the family settled in California. So all that was true. But as I was doing research, so I had challenges. I had a degree in history from Stanford, but I had no primary sources from my grandmother's family. So there was one diary that was kept for 3 days on the ship leaving Liverpool, and then that person got seasick, and that was the end of that diary. But the good part was that the Mormons keep incredible records. And so That's what I settled on and worked away. And, you know, there some of their branch people in Scotland, and then wards in Utah, those membership meetings. And there was just a lot of stuff I could find, diaries by their contemporaries. But after about 5 years or 6 years of doing research, I thought I would call one branch of the family that had settled in the northern Sacramento Valley. And I didn't know this cousin, but he had an odd name, so I was pretty sure I was going to find him. His name was Ansel Miller. And so he knew who I was, because my father was a doctor, and had his wife had gone to my father. And he mentioned that his daughter, Donna, had the trunk. Trunk? What was he talking about? I had no idea. Well, it turned out it was a trunk, a great big box, like the size of a trunk, that had belonged to the person he was descended from, Peter McGosselin. And Peter was the oldest son in the family. He was the first to convert to Mormonism. He was the first to become disillusioned. And in this trunk were drafts of letters that he had written. And in them, he tells why he converted. He had a vision. And then why he lost his faith. And then after they arrived in California, he had another vision that this was the right thing to do. So suddenly I had a gold mine. And so Peter McGosselin became the protagonist for the story. So what I didn't expect to find was about the 1850s, that they were just, you can all be very grateful you didn't live there. They had natural disasters. There were locust and cricket plagues. There was a harsh winter when half the livestock in northern Utah was died. And I'm sorry for the phone, but I can't reach it. There was the handcart disasters. There was the Mormon Reformation, when they preached blood atonement, that some sins were so bad that the only way to atone was to have your blood spilt, which meant having your neck slit and your blood falling to the ground. And then, and some of the, you know, some Mormon historians have said, well, that's just wild preaching. They didn't really mean it. But people believe Brigham Young was the prophet. And so why wouldn't they take him literally? And some bishops obviously did, because there were murders done under the aegis of bishops, especially in Springfield. So with these murders, and the time the family was living in Spanish Fork, and Springville is only 6 miles away, and the people got murdered there, were trying to leave Utah and get to California. And as soon as they got out of the city, they were murdered. So the family began to be very fearful. They didn't tell anybody that they no longer believed. But they were not too far from where the army was camped, Camp Floyd. And so they the Indian agent, the federal Indian agent, was nearby, and they went to him and told what they had found out and that they wanted help. And so eventually the army gave them they gave an escort to 40 families, at least 40 families. And it's the only time I know of when the U.S. military has given aid to religious refugees. So the family got out, and they got to California. They never joined another church. They'd become disillusioned with organized religion. But Peter McGosselin himself became a spiritualist, like the Godbeites. Amasa Lyman was one of those in the Stenhouses. But nevertheless, Peter always felt very empathetic with the Mormon people. It was the leaders he didn't like. Okay, so that's my bit. Joe? Oh, you're muted.
I do that so in case my phone rings, see, I don't have to say that.
That was
anyway, I've already gone over a little bit of Daniel Stone's, that he grew up as a member of the Church of Jesus Christ, which is headquartered in Pennsylvania, near Pittsburgh. Just one little comment about Daniel. Daniel, last June, so a year and a month ago, spoke at MHA about his book, but in the question and answer, he got into a discussion about how he was able to see records that no historian had ever been allowed. They had essentially been sealed up, and both by the church headquarters and by a member of the hierarchy who became disaffected and took records with him to another place. And so Daniel was able to bridge that gap and get to see the original records that the church had under the auspices of the Council of 12. They have a body of 12 people, where the Utah Mormons, we have a body of 15 people, 15 apostles. They only have 12 apostles, and they rotate the leadership of that, the president. And so he had to get permission to do that. And he also got permission from this disaffected former leader. And so he was able to see that. He had seen records that nobody else had ever been able to see. Mel Johnson writes about his experience writing about Lyman White and the Whiteites in mainly in Texas, but also gives a bit of the history of them being in the Pinery, which was where they did lumber for the Nauvoo Temple. But what's interesting about the Whiteites, well, many things, but one of the interesting things about the Whiteites is they had the first temple ceremony west of the Mississippi when they organized in a place they called Zodiac, which my understanding is now open fields, few rocks, basically open fields. They built structures, and in one of these structures, they performed the endowment that they had learned and received in Nauvoo. Vicki, I'm going to really turn it over to Vicki right now, because I think Vicki can actually give you much better information than I can. And since we have the privilege of having Vicki here, we should really let her do that.
Well, thank you. I started to research the Strangites because I wanted to know why I had never learned about them before. I grew up in Idaho. I went to seminary. I went to Ricks College. I was a devout Mormon, and I had never, ever heard of James Strang and the Strangites. I found out that Strang was a major contender for taking people away from Nauvoo and taking people away from Brigham Young. There were a lot of people, maybe even 2,000-3,000 people, who went with James Strang instead of going to Utah with Brigham Young. Now, why would that be, I thought? I thought it must be because people were poor. They didn't want to go to some place across the country that they had never heard of. They didn't even know where they were going. And what do you do if you've got a sick grandma, you got a sick mother, you're poor? Well, then you go to the nearest community, which was Burlington or Voree with James Strang. And for a long time, I thought that's what it was. I thought that's what the draw was of James Strang. Then I found out that it really, well, and so what I thought was, well, those people who went with James Strang really wanted to be members of the church, but they just didn't have enough faith to go west. So I had this idea, and I look back on it with abhorrence and with embarrassment, but such arrogance. I decided that I wanted to have the teenagers in our stake do baptisms for the dead, for the Strangites. I was going to collect all the names and put them together into the families, and I was going to give them to the stake, and then they could baptize, the kids could baptize all these Strangites, into the Utah church, because after all, that's what they would have wanted. And I look back with such arrogance, and I can't believe I believe that. But I went to my Uncle Dave in Idaho. My Uncle Dave was one of my very favorites in Idaho, and he would always greet me with the words, "So, Vicki, do you still believe the church is true?" And I thought, well, that's something really odd that for somebody to say. He was in the high council. He was busy in his stakes. He had a missionary. He had a lot of pull with the church. And I couldn't understand why he would say that. So I told him about my idea of having the kids do the baptisms for the dead. And he said, did you ever read that book that I told you about, Grant Palmer's book, An Insider's View to Mormon Origins? I said, no. He says, go home and read it. Give me a call. So I went home, I read it, and I called him, and he said, so, Vicki, you still believe the church is true? And I said, why didn't you tell me? And he said, that's something that you had to figure out on your own. I couldn't tell you. So he put me in contact with some other enlightening materials, including Thomas Murphy and Simon Southerton. And I found out that there was no Hebrew blood in the Lamanites. And all of a sudden, things started getting screwed up. And there was another little thing that really bothered me, and that was the fact that James Strang dug up ancient buried records. They were supposedly buried under 3 feet of soil under an oak tree, and an angel told the word to find them. He and some other men went there, and they dug up the plates, and James Strang translated them. And I couldn't figure out what to think about them, because I believed that Joseph Smith was a prophet and that James Strang was a charlatan. So if these weren't true, then he's a charlatan as well. So, and then suddenly I found out that I found a document that said that Uncle Ben had an old kettle, an old brass kettle. And they made those into the plates and then used an auger to put them in the hillside. So all of a sudden I had my answer. And I had, by that time, I had completely lost my faith in Mormonism. I was no longer attending church. And I didn't know what to do. I distinctly remember the bishop coming to my door with his counselors, and I thought, oh boy, they're about to excommunicate me. So they came in and they said, so we heard that you have some problems with the church. And I said, yes, I do. And one of the counselors said, well, did you pray about it? And I thought, how do I respond to this guy? And he said, no, did you really pray about it? And I said, do you really think that I would decide something this important without praying about it? And he was chagrined, apologized to me for asking that question. Well, I didn't receive an answer to the prayers that I thought I would. I thought that I'd receive an answer that said, yes, Mormonism is true. But all I received was an answer that said, you are my daughter, and I love you. And I am proud of you just the way you are. That has been my consolation in leaving Mormonism, that I know that God loves me, that I am his daughter, and that he is proud of me. But it was a hard place to go to. And I hurt some people that I loved dearly when I left the church. I have had my names removed from the church because of the November Declaration about the children of gays and lesbians, but that's okay. I'm making my own decisions, and I know that what I'm doing is pioneering in my own right, just as the people that I came from pioneered on theirs. Back to you, Joe.
So was I right in asking Vicki and Polly to be part of this? I think I was very right. They are both amazing people, and I'm very, very, very lucky that I get to call them my friends. I'm going to wrap up a little bit, and then I think, Heather, do we have any questions?
We do, actually. We have some very good questions.
Okay,
I'll make over here waiting
okay.
on pins and needles until you're done.
Great. I'm going to make it quick. Vicki's talked about her experience and the toll that it took on her as a member. There are others that it took a toll on. Linda Newell and Val Avery were both forbidden to speak on Emma Smith in any type of a religious setting that occurred. They actually had to, or Linda was able to meet with two members of the Quorum of the Twelve because her stake president was friends and able to do that. But the answers that they got were not very, very good answers. Both Will Bagley and Val Avery both ended up having divorces very shortly in that period of time of their books. And Val and Linda and Vicki has given her outline of the experience of moving outside of Mormonism. The ultimate price for a Mormon would be excommunication, and one of the authors did have that, D. Michael Quinn, though that you will not find. Mike has written about that extensively. It's published in Sunstone. It's published in a book called Faithful History. So if you're interested in Mike's experience of being excommunicated, you'd want to turn to those two. Okay, Heather.
All right, I'm going to unmute myself for a second. I think I have a question. Oh, that would be my alarm that says it's time for me to remind you that we're going to have Q&A. So, sorry.
Oh, that's good.
I had 30 seconds of not quite fast enough finger there.
Well, thank Polly for thus being on time. Polly is got it right, you know.
I have a couple questions I have a question for Joe, a question for everybody, a couple questions for Vicki, and a couple questions that are Vicki and Polly or just Polly. Does anybody care what order I go into?
I don't.
Well, then let's go. All right. So writing history for non-historians, whether to read or the people that are non-historians also writing the history. Do you have any tips for jumping in for people that have not chosen history from a professional standpoint, but would like to be able to develop that skill in themselves?
I'm going to turn that over to Polly and Vicki. I think they...
Yeah, neither one of us was a writer. You know, well, I was a writer, but I wasn't trained in history, and I'm still not trained. I'm a newspaper reporter. So just do it. Just find something that you really like, that you want to learn about, research it, and then put it down, and it'll come together.
Yeah, I my training is in journalism and research as well, and it really just... That's an interesting thing to think about, that intersection of just, well, you just apply it to a different thing, right?
Right.
I found that.
What are you thinking, Polly?
Well, I found that although I had a degree in history, it was in modern European history. And what did I know about Mormonism or Utah history or Scottish history? And so I just started reading books. And then books have decent books, have historical books, have footnotes and bibliographies. And so, you know, something would interest you, then I would go look up those books. And then often it meant interlibrary loan because the Seattle Library didn't have them. And then eventually I realized, okay, I need to really look at diaries and I need to look at membership, lists. And I need to know what it was like to go on the ocean and go on an ox train or handcart company. And so, and the Church History Library has lots of those. Right. And the people who work there are very generous with their time. The Utah State Historical Society is also very generous with their materials. In fact, more generous. There's open stacks in most of it. And so just one thing leads to another. But I would start with general books that you can get hold of. And then let their footnotes lead you to other places.
And I would just like to say that there, the only difference between a writer and a historian is footnotes.
Yes.
And when the mistake I made when I was first starting to research and stuff is I didn't write down the sources of my materials. So I'd have a great manuscript and I couldn't find it again because I didn't know where it was. So that's the only thing is, you know, write your footnotes down from the very beginning so you can find it later on.
Yeah.
Fantastic answers.
Yeah, that's very intelligent and a good, Polly, along with that, not to segue, but can you tell us about how your creative writing background sort of factored in to writing about history? Because we were talking about, you know, keeping track of things in writing. I love reading historical novels. How do you find that intersection in what you do?
So my background was in history, not in writing. And at one point, a woman who taught creative writing at Southern Methodist University that I got to know, she said, you know, this would make a great fiction. And I thought, I don't think so, but maybe I should think about that. And so I finally took a course through the University of Washington Extension that was a year-long course in fiction writing. And I thought, well, no matter which way I decide to go, that techniques of fiction writing can be used in historical writing. Description of characters, description of place, character development, all those things are factors that are useful in writing history. So I took a year-long course and decided I was definitely not a novelist.
I'm not either.
the problem I had was I wanted to know what had happened to this family and why. And so that there was just, my imagination wasn't broad enough to just launch off into space. So, but that course gave me confidence in writing. And so then I felt I could maybe do this.
Yeah, that's really cool. That's really cool. Okay, for Vicki and Polly both, I was struck by the patriarchal nature of Mormon history academia in all four chapters of WMH. Would you be willing to share some of your personal experiences with it and how that affects your work?
So I'm not sure I understand the question. Our experience with what?
I'm not positive. Maybe Blake can or Bryce can extrapolate for us. I think what he is saying was that because LDS history a lot of times does have a lot of focus on what was happening with the men. It just does. I mean, we worry about the leadership. We worry about what they're doing, the decisions that were made, the wars, the conflicts that were involved. And a lot of times we get missed. That's something in my own writing that most of my poetry is from the perspective of somebody that otherwise might not have a voice. When you're doing your research, do you find yourself trying to look for those experiences and trying to find those firsthand accounts, just like you were discussing.
Right. Yeah, at least for myself, I was writing about a foot soldier, a Mormon foot soldier. And I was only interested in the leadership in relation to what was going on in Peter McCausland's life. So, and I just kept digging. And that was why it took me so darn long, because things aren't written much about foot soldiers.
Right.
Vicki, what about
yes,
you?
It is hard to find information about the women. So you basically have to look at the lives of the men and the brothers and what was going around the women, and that will often give you a clue, because women are mentioned in letters, and they're mentioned in
journals,
documents and things like that. I tried and tried and tried to find a document where one of Strang's wives had to give up her children when she was very ill, and she had to put them up for families, basically indentured servitude. You know, but I just could not find that document. But if you look for the men, then a lot of times you'll find the information about the women.
Right. Okay, while I have you here, Vicki, the LDS Church has done a huge service to historians by digitizing many of the records. How hard was it to track down records about the Strangites without any major digital repository? And along with that, not the same question, but as a non-Strangite writing the biography of Strang, did you ever feel like an outsider to that, or were you welcome into the world, or was it just kind of, was the information forthcoming versus were you seen as an outsider that was trying to pry?
Well, you basically have to, what we had to do back in the 90s is we had to do a lot of traveling and a lot of letter writing. I've traveled myself to a lot of libraries across the country, and I ordered a microfilm of letters from Beinecke Library that had a Strangite letter collection. It cost me $35 for the microfilm, which contained probably 800 letters or more. And then I took it to the library in my town and was able to copy it. But otherwise, it would have cost me 10 to 20 cents per page if I had to copy it someplace else. So I'm really excited about the digital collections now. And it's much easier to find documents. As far as the Strangites, I have one very dear friend, Bill Shepherd. I've met him at a John Whitmer Historical Association meeting. I went deliberately to that meeting in order to meet Bill Shepherd. I introduced myself to him, and he says, well, come on, let's go to lunch. So we went to a little small restaurant in downtown Nauvoo, and there were four Strangites, two Mormons, a Community of Christ, and an Episcopalian. And we all sat there and had sandwiches together and discussed Mormon history. There's
no
jealousy.
That sounds like the start of an awesome joke.
It was. We were all walking each other home.
Good. Very awesome.
Basically.
I love
that. They're a very welcome congregation in Voree. Bill Shepherd has a very open home, and he has invited hundreds of people to come in and stay with them and provided information to hundreds of people.
That's awesome. Very awesome, and as it should be. Joe, I have a question for you, and then I'll open one last question for everybody. Joe, your question is, I've personally seen your exceptional abilities in herding cats. Can you tell us a bit about the struggles and roadblocks in putting this book together? I personally describe it as having ducks, trying to put your ducks in a row, and then the ducks decide to have a rave. Because that's what it's like when you're trying to put it together, right?
Yes, this actually sounds like a question from Bill McKinnon, but I don't know if that is who asked it. Was it Bill? No, yeah. Okay. Yeah, you know, I guess I feel super lucky because it actually went very smooth. the publisher, I always felt like Gary and Ron and John Hatch and all those people at Signature Books were always there for me. The same is true actually with the authors. I know that there can be issues, but knock on wood, in this particular situation, I was very lucky.
And when you're working with a great publishing team, it really matters. Really matters. They have good communication and everything just starts to flow smoothly. And you're like, oh, we can actually make a book, can't we?
That's right. And the authors, these 15 authors were amazing. So,
well, especially having so many in one place, having excellence in that and having them produce all of their work at the same high quality makes a big difference too.
That's right.
Okay. Last question. It's kind of a nebulous one, but you'll come up with something. What are your favorite stories from Mormon history?
Vicki, Polly, and then me. How's that?
Okay. That sounds good.
Okay. Well, it's from Strangite, Mormon history. James Strang took a woman with him when he went on a missionary trip to New York. He was already married. He met young Elvira Field, who was 18 years old. He cut her hair, dressed her as a man, and took her with him when he was on his mission. And one of my very favorite stories is reading in a letter how Elvira had tried to play the accordion, and it did not go good. It did not go well.
I can only imagine, because accordion is not something that would sound perfectly wonderful when you first start to learn anyways. Polly, what about you?
Well, there's so many stories, but because we're here now, the best story I know of is Vicky's going off, taking a basket weaving course and needing some material and having to go to Wisconsin for it. And going down a road that said Mormon Road, she had no idea what it was. I mean, how would she have ever stumbled across the Strangites except for that course? It just seems so improbable. It's such a great story.
And they always say that basket weaving isn't going to take you anywhere or isn't going to progress you in your career very much. Apparently, that's not true at all, is it?
No.
Well, what about you, Joe?
Well, Polly's comment reminded me of something the other day. There was somebody that went through to find all the strange names of towns in every state. California's is Mormon Bar. Now, I know what that is all about. Yes, okay, Polly, you got it. But for a somebody who's never been Mormon, which is the people that we're talking about on the radio, Mormon Bar, you know, what an oxymoron, you know. But knowing, and I think because I'm a native Californian and I'm a third generation native Californian, actually. I mean, Polly goes back just like I do in California. I would say that the gold discovery is one of the, when I discovered that, and I've discovered a lot of crazy stuff, but that was exciting to read Henry Bigler's account right in his journal. And the only reason we know the day that gold was discovered at Sutter's Mill was because of his journal.
Yeah. Magnificent. Yeah. Vicki, I have one more question for you. Oh, wait, Joe, I have one more question for you. Perry Porter would like to know where you're going for dinner tonight.
Yeah, I get to work tonight, Perry.
All right.
And I'm not in Utah.
That's too bad. Let's go to the Thai place.
That's right.
Right? Okay, and Vicki, we would like to hear your thoughts briefly on Miles Harvey's new book, The King of Confidence.
I met Miles Harvey, and he told me that he is a big fan of mine, that he loves my book, and he used it for the basis of understanding Strang, and then he built on it. So he was able to find new information about James Strang because of my book. I was very flattered. So it is a good book.
That's lovely to hear.
It's written more for general audiences. So it's okay, but he does have an agenda that he does think that Strang was a confidence man.
Yeah, fascinating. Well, I wanted to thank you all for being here today. I always feel so honored to be able to learn all these intersections in history and to learn from the people that have genuinely studied. And I'm grateful to have been a part of this session and to listen to you all. And thank you so much for being here. Going to be closing out the session, but people can continue talking in the Whova app or whatever like that. And I hope you all do have a lovely dinner, even if it's not in Utah.
Okay.
Y'all have a great day. Thank you again.
Thank you.
Right. Bye-bye.